Before I forget, could I get a copy of that last song, the music? I wear a lot of different hats at Shema. One of them is worship leader. So I'm always looking for wonderful worshipful songs, and that was great. Not that the others weren't great, but this one I'm taking home. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you again. I keep thinking, sooner or later, how long can you be gluttons for punishment? It really is good to be back. Last time I was here, I think I was dressed a little too nicely. One of the ladies came up to me and said, "Is everything okay? I didn't recognize you." And then I was a little too sore and tired this morning. It was just a little bit too chilly for me to ride the motorcycle. I figured I'll compromise. So this is Texas business casual. That's good to be with you again. Let me just mention also, you know, as I do each time, I did bring my wife's greeting cards with me if you're wanting some greeting cards. Tonight, guys, when I come back, I'm going to be bringing just a whole bunch of stuff that you might be interested in, some good books. Also, we have these T-shirts that we like to wear whenever we do outreach and sometimes even when we're not. They say, "Jesus made me kosher." And we use those things, and I tell you, it's engendered more conversations. It's just a fantastic witnessing tool. Last week, I was at the gym and wearing that shirt, and three different times in that one evening, people came up to me. "What does that mean? That is so funny." So, I'm glad you asked. This morning, let me just ask your indulgence. We're going to go a little bit long this morning, okay? Just giving you a heads up. We're going to go a little bit long. My average message is 14-point font Times New Roman, 6 or 7 pages. This one is like 10 or 11 or something. But I'm not going to read every last word, but we might go, you know, 5-10 minutes over. If you get up, I'm going to call you out. No pressure. I do want to invite you to open your Bible to John chapter 11. I've been here at Dunning Park so many times, and I love it. I don't want you to misunderstand, but I can't even remember anymore all the sermons I've preached here. If I had been smart all along, I would have been putting the dates when I gave this message and the dates. I don't think I gave this one, though. John chapter 11. You know, we've just celebrated Jesus' resurrection from the dead, and I like the fact that we're still singing and declaring his resurrection. You know, that week has come and gone when people you don't see all year long suddenly show up, and then just as quickly they're gone. And we're still singing his resurrection. So, but we're going to talk about a different resurrection this morning. And the message is Mechaye Metim. Did I translate that for you? I didn't. Anybody want to take a guess? The one who raises the dead. Mechaye Metim. It's actually part of a prayer in the synagogues. And this is number 6 of the 7 signs, these public miracles that Jesus performed, meant to authenticate his claim to be the one true promised Messiah of Israel and Savior of the world. It's number 6 out of 7. So in John chapter 11, we're going to be reading about Yeshua raising a man from the dead. I consider Jesus' resurrection to be number 7. 7, the number of completion. Perfection. His own resurrection from the dead on the third day would be the 7th. This is the 6th. Look with me at verses 1-3. "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany." This morning we're going to be calling him Eliezer. That's how you would say that in Hebrew, Eliezer. "My God is a help." Ezer means help. "A certain man was sick, Lazarus," or Eliezer of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. "It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sisters sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Let's get a little background on the village of Bethany. It's the trigger thing, right? Is this on maybe or not on? It's on. There we go. This is taken, a picture taken in the village of Bethany at the tomb that is considered to be the tomb of Lazarus. People are still visiting it to this day. And God willing, I'm going to be there in October. And by the way, just thank you for your generosity when I come and speak, because actually this is going to help pay for my way to get back to Israel. But I am coming back, I think. Okay. Bethany is from Syriac words, Beit, house of, right? Beth, Beit, house of, and Anya, affliction. How'd you like to be from a town called the house of affliction or the house of poverty? There is a little town called Hanging Dog, Texas. How'd you like to be from a town called the house of affliction? Wow. This small village is about a mile and a half from Jerusalem. It's on the southeastern slope of the Mount of Olives. It's the part of the Mount of Olives you never see. Because, you know, every mountain has two sides. We always see the Mount of Olives facing west toward Jerusalem. We don't see the house of poverty. Its name suggests that this town may have been a designated place for the caring of the sick. You know, in ancient Middle East, oftentimes they would have special areas or villages set up for those who needed medical care. So it could be that the Bethany was a place for the caring of the sick or the impoverished. Mark chapter 14 indicates that Bethany was the home of Simon the leper, which again would support this thesis. Bethany is regarded as a suburb of Jerusalem, though it is part of what is commonly misnamed the West Bank. It's been suggested on the basis of thousands of inscriptions on ossuaries excavated there. Let me point out, what you're looking at is called an ossuary, a bone box. In ancient Israel, in the first century, the common practice was when a person died, you prepared their body, but Israelis didn't embalm their dead. They wrapped them and anointed them and wrapped them and placed them. They would carve out a tomb in a cave, a rock, hollow it out, and they would put the deceased there. A year later, they would come back, and by that time, because the body had not been embalmed, all that would be left would be the bones. They would take those bones and they would put them in these funerary boxes called ossuary, from osseo, Greek for bone. And there would typically be inscriptions on them. Well, it's been suggested on the basis of thousands of inscriptions on ossuaries excavated there at Bethany that in Yeshua's time it was settled by a large number of Galileans. You can tell that based on the names and the particulars that are put on some of these ossuaries. They figured out that it was sort of like a lot of people from Kentucky came to Michigan and settled where? Taylor. A lot of people from the Galilee up in the north came to Judea and settled in Bethany. And they figured that out. So it makes sense that Yeshua's good friends, fellow Galileans, because he himself was Galilean, lived in Bethany. It makes a lot of sense. Maybe they had all grown up together. And so maybe whenever he was in Jerusalem, he made it a point to visit his friends over there in Bethany. Let's get a little background on the family of Lazarus, or Eliezer. We're told that this is the same Miriam, or Mary, who anointed Yeshua's feet and wiped them with her hair when he had been at the home of Simon the leper. Now, some people mistakenly believe this is the same event recorded in Luke chapter 7. It is not. Sometimes things happen more than once. As it turns out, two different women at two different times, out of love for him, anointed his feet with myrrh and wiped them with her hair. In Luke 7, you've got this sinful woman of the city, presumably Jerusalem, because it's the city, and also presumably because Yeshua was dining with one of the Pharisees at the time. So a woman there called a sinful woman of the city did the very same thing for him, but that refers ahead to the events, if we were in John, of like chapters 12 and 13. The fact that two similar events took place at two different times is not hard to accept. By the way, further evidence that this Mary who anointed his feet was not the scandalous woman in Luke 7 is that every time Bethany is mentioned in the Gospels, it is referred to as komi, a village, rather than poli, city. So that distinction is not arbitrary. A village is a village. A city is a city. Simon the leper and Simon the Pharisee were two different Simons. I mean, Simon was a very common name in Israel. It's like Mike, Steve, Jim. There was obviously a very good friendship between Jesus, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, the siblings, but chiefly between Yeshua and Eliezer. Again, his name means "My God is a help." What a great name. I end up with Glenn. You know, it might be difficult for us to imagine Jesus having a best friend, because we would tend to think, well, that ain't fair. How's that fair? He's supposed to be the Lord. He's supposed to be impartial. He was fully human as well as fully divine. Would we deny him the prerogative that we reserve for ourselves all the time? Right? He was a very good friend. I suggest this just attests to his genuine humanity. In any case, what a privilege for these three, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, who otherwise lived in a place called the House of Affliction, to have Yeshua as a very good and close friend. As chapter 11 unfolds, we see just how true and deep their friendship is. Here in the first three verses, we find out that Eliezer is sick, sick enough that the sisters sent word to him, and noticed that they didn't even need to say his name. Just simply, "He whom you love is sick." It demonstrated how close they were. At the end of chapter 10, we were told that Yeshua was in the Judean wilderness, beyond the Jordan. Well, here's a question. Did Mary and Martha know that? How long did it take for the messengers they sent to find him? It's very possible that whoever they sent to go find him might have gone into Jerusalem first and spent some time there and then finally found out where he was. We don't know. But even if they knew he was in the wilderness, it had to have taken at least a day or two to find him. So by the time Jesus receives word of Eliezer's sickness, his grave illness, precious time has been lost. But think about this. He's the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Do you think he didn't know? Do you think he wouldn't have known if they hadn't sent somebody to go get him? Of course he knew. Verse 4. But when Yeshua heard this, he said, "This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." Eliezer's sickness would lead to death, but it would not end in death. That's the important point for us. But the disciples didn't know what he meant. They probably thought it meant that Lazarus' recovery from such a serious illness would bring glory to God. So for the moment, they're relieved, but they had absolutely no idea what was coming. Let's focus for a moment on the fact that Yeshua referred to God and to himself on equal terms. "This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." Who should be glorified but God alone? You see the audacity in what he's saying. He's attesting to his equality with the Father. And the Bible consistently warns man not to receive glory or to give glory to one another, but only to God alone. So we're therefore left to conclude that Jesus considered himself God, or we're left to believe that he was a madman. I let you make that choice, but I think we all are on the same page with that. He refers to himself, oh, by the way, that's That's an inscription on one of those ossuaries that says Yaakov, Jacob, which, again, a very common name. There's a gazillion Jacobs. All right. The Son of God. He refers to himself as, in third person, as the Son of God. And sadly, many people have misunderstood what that expression means. Muslims reject it because they crudely and mistakenly think that by the term Son of God, we think that God had sex and Jesus was the result. Most Jewish people don't know what to make of it. But, you know, because my Jewish people have been indoctrinated to reject Jesus as the Messiah, they don't know what to make of it. They incorrectly assume that we hold to multiple gods. We don't. One God. Tripersonal. That's all. But even some people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah have failed to understand what the title Son of God means in the Jewish context. And they assume it somehow means less than God. It does not. Not by a long shot. To read a 21st century idea into a first century figure of speech is to do disservice. We need to do our homework. We need to understand how did people at that time understand this expression, Son of God. In ancient Israel, to be called a son of something, fill in the blank, meant that you were the epitome of that quality or that virtue. So, for example, a scoundrel, somebody who's a real scoundrel might be called Ben Belial, a son of the evil one. Didn't mean literally they were Satan's child, but that they behaved like that. In fact, that was what Nabal, Abigail's wicked first husband, was called, a son of Belial, a son of wickedness, somebody who was just characterized by wickedness. A wise woman might be called Bat-Or, daughter of light. Didn't mean that light was her dad's name or that light gave birth. It meant she was wise. She was extremely wise, the epitome of wisdom. We have a New Testament example of just such a moniker. Joseph, a man from Cyprus who was called Barnabas, son of encouragement. His father's name wasn't encouragement. He simply epitomized. He was the quintessential encourager. But the expression Son of God, I must tell you, was a title that was held in reserve for the Messiah and him only. The quintessential king of Israel. So for him to be called or call himself Son of God is to be fully equated with God. By the way, not to be misunderstood or confused with the term the sons of God, which can refer to human beings or angels, depending on the context. No, Son of God is a singular title that was always held in reserve for the Messiah. So the fact that Jesus calls himself that, every time he says that, he's claiming to be the one. So Rabbi Paul could say in Colossians 2:9, in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And it is why the writer of the letter to the Messianic Jews, otherwise known as Hebrews, could also say categorically, in these last days, he, God, has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. There's only one creator. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. So when you hear the term Son of God, please do not think less than. Not at all. All right, verses 5 through 10. Yeah, Jesus is not an approximation. He's not a facsimile. He's very God of very God, as the confession goes. All right, verses 5 through 10. Now Yeshua loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, yet when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jewish leaders were just now seeking to stone you. And are you going there again? Yeshua answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. Now try to imagine with me how the disciples were feeling during these 2 days. Now, Yeshua had assured them that Lazarus' sickness wouldn't end in death, but right now, what they know is he's gravely ill, and Jesus seems to be dawdling. No rush to get to him. What's going on? He seems in no particular hurry. I'm sure they're wondering, and maybe even quietly discussing this among themselves, this seemingly inexplicable delay. Finally, he announces that they're returning to Judea. But instead of saying, Lord, why did you wait so long, right? You would think, finally, why did you wait? No, that's not what they said. They said, are you kidding? Just a few days ago, the religious leaders, they were trying to kill you. And now you want to go there? Maybe they figured that was what was behind his delay in going to see Eliezer. If word got to Jerusalem, which is a 15, 20-minute walk, from Bethany, if word gets to Jerusalem that he's there in nearby Bethania, it might provoke another possibly lethal confrontation. But this wasn't about fear. As usual, it was Jesus doing things according to the Father's time frame and nobody else's. He never allowed people's demands or circumstances to dictate how or when he would do things. He knew full well when that conflict and when that confrontation was to reach its zenith, and did exactly what was needed when it was needed to see that it was fulfilled. Now, concerning the right time to do things, in a sense, Jesus is saying, carpe diem, seize the day. When action is needed, don't put it off. We must not let fear deter us. His analogy of night versus day, walking versus stumbling, is a call to courage and determination. It's the challenge of the good news. We need to preach it now, not, well, I'll get around to it eventually. No, we cannot allow fear of what people think of us to outweigh our determination to carry out the Great Commission. All right, verses 11 to 16. This he said, and after that he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go so that I may awaken him out of sleep. The disciples then said to him, Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover. Now, Yeshua had spoken of his death, but they thought he was speaking of literal sleep. So Yeshua said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe, but let us go to him. Therefore, Thomas, who is called Didymus, the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go so that we may die with him. Don't you love that guy? I want you to note something here. Yeshua just told them they're going back to Judea, and here he specifically says it's to see Eliezer, who lives in the village of Bethania, or Bethany. Today, Bethany is called El Azaria, so named after Eliezer, actually named after him. But, you know, this is a little side note from yours truly, but Bethany is considered part of what is called or so-called West Bank. It's called the West Bank. That's what Israel's enemies call it. That's what the mainstream media calls it, but you know what the scriptures call it? Judea and Samaria. Just had to put that up there. I'm sharing. That's my Facebook wall for the moment. I think we should follow Yeshua's example. He called it Judea. Why would we call it West Bank? Yeshua tells them he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead, but he employs a common euphemism of the day. He's asleep. Describing death as sleep. At first, they don't get it, and that's understandable since he had already said that it wouldn't end in death. But finally, he spells it out for them. Eliezer has died. He then says that for their sake, and this is what must have really freaked them out, because what do you make of this? He says that he's glad he wasn't there so that they may believe. And you and I are thinking, oh, that makes perfect sense. He was going to raise them from the dead and it would help their faith. Yeah, but they're the ones living it out in real time. What does he mean? How could Eliezer dying be good? And why would he say he's glad he wasn't there? And how is this going to make us believe? You see, if Yeshua had been there, he might have been tempted in his humanity to try to prevent his death. But he knew it was necessary that the disciples personally witness him raise the dead. And he knew the outcome would be good. But think about this. 11 of these 12 men were going to become the apostles, the ones who would carry this message to the world. It was vital that these who would become the bedrock of the faith be absolutely clear on just how much authority this Jesus had. It was crucial. They had to see this. Furthermore, their confession of Jesus would eventually cost each of these men their lives. Seeing him raise Lazarus from the dead firsthand would, in retrospect, help cement their faith and enable them to be resolute in each of their hour of testing. Well, Thomas pipes up and says, "Come on, guys, let's go and die with him." Quintessential cynicism and maybe a bit of wry humor intended there, but that's Thomas. How ironic that this bold declaration of willingness to die for Jesus coming from the one who ended up skeptical about his resurrection. But the truth of the matter is that an authentic disciple is prepared, if need be, to forfeit his life for his Lord and Messiah. All right, verse 17. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. My friends, that little detail, 4 days, is extraordinary in its importance. It's enormous. A common Jewish belief of the day was that a soul would hover around the grave where the person was buried for 3 days, hoping somehow to be reunited with the body. But after 3 days, any sort of resuscitation was considered beyond hope. The rabbis employed a euphemism. On the fourth day, the appearance has changed, referring to rigor mortis setting in. Yeshua delayed those additional 2 days so that by raising a man who had been dead for 4 days, any attempt to explain it away on the basis of some kind of resuscitation would be laughable, would be completely unacceptable. It would be seen as foolishness. All right, verses 18 and following. Now, Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Yeshua was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Yeshua said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Yeshua said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I have believed that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." When she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Well, what was happening here? The family was sitting Shiva. Shiva is from the Hebrew word meaning seven. 7 days of mourning for their deceased. So they're all, it's a customary Jewish practice. The mourner remains in the home for 7 days, receives friends and loved ones, bringing consolation. Naturally, many of their Jewish friends came to offer sympathy. For Martha to suddenly get up and leave the house was a break with custom. Understand that that would have been considered strange, inappropriate. But the news that Messiah Jesus was coming and approaching the village impelled her to get up and run and meet him. John tells us that Mary stayed at the house, but the word "stayed" is actually a form of the verb meaning to sit. Again, sitting Shiva, mourning. Okay, now, let's see. Okay. Martha's referring to Jesus as the teacher brings to mind Jesus' words to his disciples. He said, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet." And of course, the words of Isaiah, written 700 years earlier, "Although the Lord has given you bread of privation," remember the name of the town? The house of affliction or the house of poverty. "Although the Lord has given you the bread of privation and the water of oppression, he, your teacher, will no longer hide himself, but your eyes will behold your teacher." Jesus the Messiah is in fact the Lord and the teacher, our supreme rabbi. Well, Martha came to Jesus lamenting that he hadn't been there to save her brother, but declares her faith that even now she believes he has the authority to raise him, to summon him from the dead. What a powerful confession. Jesus tells her that Eliezer will rise again, and she naturally takes him to be talking about the resurrection on the last day, which, of course, Jewish people for thousands of years have believed, based on the words of the prophets, such as those words of Daniel. Oops. Oh, how do I back up? This way? Oh, great. Can you back it up from there? One more or two. Back again. There we go. All right, Daniel. I never claimed to be the most organized person in the world. Daniel in chapter 12 wrote this, "Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." But Jesus had something more immediate in mind when he said, let's find the slide that says, "I'm the resurrection and the life." There we go. He had something more immediate in mind. "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." Now, it's just beyond me how anybody can read these words and go on to say that Jesus was just a good teacher. I mean, who says things like this unless they're God or a madman? All right, and then he puts the question to her, "Do you believe this?" And Martha, again, affirms her faith, saying, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." Well, good for you, Martha. You've spoken well. You've believed correctly. And then she takes off for the house to get Mary, apparently because Jesus asked for her. I don't think we need to make too much of the fact that Jesus didn't enter the house and sit Shiva with him. Considering what he was about to do, why would he? It would have made no sense. All right, verse 30 to 37. "Now Yeshua had not yet come into the village. He was still in the place where Martha met him. Then the Judeans, right, the Jewish leaders who were with her in the house and consoling her, when they saw that Mary got up quickly and went out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Therefore, when Mary came to where Yeshua was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' When Yeshua saw her weeping and saw the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled and said, 'Where have you laid him?' They said to him, 'Lord, come and see.' Yeshua wept." So the Judeans were saying, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man also from dying?" And Miriam says the very same thing that Martha had said. We don't know whether she's scolding him, like, "What took you so long? Why didn't you come?" Or simply affirming her faith that he had the power to save her brother. And that isn't the point. What we should get from this is the deep sense of loss and grief over the death of their beloved brother and Yeshua's dearest friend. Jesus takes in the scene. He's looking at the people weeping, the sisters weeping, the Jewish people who had come to mourn with them weeping, and he's deeply moved. By the way, the word translated "moved" here isn't typically used of grieving. In ancient Greek literature, the verb that John uses here connotes, are you ready for this? Not grief. When it says he was moved, the Greek word here is actually the word used in extra-biblical literature to convey the idea of the snorting of an angry horse. He wasn't heartbroken. He was righteously angry. Because what does death represent but everything that the enemy of God has wrought upon humanity? Yeshua was angry. Well, who with? Not with the sisters. Their grief was understandable, and so he's not scolding them. He wasn't angry with the Jewish mourners, by the way, several of whom would have been professional, paid mourners. I know that sounds weird, but if more people were there to mourn at the house of those mourning, it was considered that it elevated that family stature. Like, wow, okay, this must have been a very important person. Though he's not angry with them, I don't think. D.A. Carson points out that Jewish funeral customs dictated that even a poor family was expected to hire at least 2 flute players and a professional wailing woman. And he gets that from the Talmud. That's in Mishnah Ketubot. Some point to the hypocrisy of such a callous, opportunistic form of profit-making as the reason for Jesus' anger, but I think it was something else altogether. Perhaps in that moment, the omniscient, all-knowing Messiah looked across the span of time, both back to the murder of Abel and to the end of human history looking forward, and considered all the collective grief of 1,000 generations of human mourning for dead friends and loved ones. And in that moment, burned with anger at the one truly responsible for it, at Satan. But he wept. Messiah's humanity was very real. He's fully God and fully man. And in his 33 years of life in this fallen world, Yeshua experienced every weakness and grief and despair that any of us ever felt. And I would say more than any of us will ever know. Verses 38 to 44. So Yeshua, again being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they removed the stone. Just a short time earlier, Martha had confessed, "Even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask for." Well, it's one thing to believe, and it's another thing to act on it. If the Lord told you to do something really radical, really weird in the eyes of the world, would you do it? But what he was about to do and what he told them to do would have been considered scandalous. But he was about to do something extraordinary. Martha initially protests on the basis of what is certainly the stench of a rotting corpse. And make no mistake about it, after 4 days, that's what's in a tomb. Then Yeshua raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it so that they may believe that you sent me." Jesus prays out loud. It's not a show of piety. It's for the sake of those standing there who are about to see something amazing. It's really for the benefit of Mary and Martha and his disciples more than anybody. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice. Get there? "Lazarus, come forth." And I'm sure there was a hushed pause, waiting to see what was about to happen. And just like people now, can you really do that? Well, they didn't have to wait very long. The man who had died came forth bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Yeshua said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Eliezer of Bethany was alive again after being dead 4 days beyond any hope of resuscitation. He walked, or I guess he would have shuffled, out of that tomb. Can you imagine the shock and the amazement of everybody who was standing there? Even the disciples who had witnessed many other miracles had to be standing there with their mouths wide open in amazement. Nobody ever did this. This was after 4 days. Simply by fiat, by his word, Jesus of Nazareth spoke life back into the body of a dead man. If he is M'chaye Metim, the one who raises the dead, who gives life to the dead, then he is Lord and God, and he can do all things. But imagine if instead of saying, Lazarus, come forth, he had left off Lazarus's name. It could have been the resurrection of all mankind. And maybe that's going to be his word on that day. Finally, verses 45 and 46. Therefore, many of the Judeans who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Yeshua had done. As we've come to expect, you know, those of us familiar with John's gospel, there's a mixed reaction to the wonder-working rabbi. Some of the paid professional mourners put their trust in him right then and there, and others went off to tell the religious leaders what had happened. But what about Mary and Martha and the disciples who already believed in him as the Messiah? I'm sure they experienced a kind of deep, almost inexpressible validation of their faith. They had to have been overwhelmed at this mixture of awe and rejoicing. They have their brother back and their dear friend. Well, we find out in chapter 12 that this event made Lazarus into something of a local celebrity. You're the one who was dead, right? Yep. A short time later, Jesus and the disciples held their Passover Seder at Lazarus' house, and everyone was coming around to see the guy who had been dead and raised from the dead, and to see the one who raised him up. But the Jewish religious leaders, now thoroughly terrified of what this miracle represented, and jealous for their position, acted just like Pharaoh of old, and just like Herod, and began to plot to murder him. And they were plotting to murder Lazarus as well. After all, you can't have a resurrected guy walking around and influencing people. Well, what's the point of this? After all, Eliezer was eventually going to die again. And not very much later, the religious leaders got their wish when Jesus the Messiah was put to death, courtesy of a Jewish mob and a spineless Roman procurator. The point is this. If you're a follower of Jesus, you are going to meet this guy Lazarus. You're going to meet Jesus too. You're going to meet the sisters. You're going to meet the 11 apostles. All on the day when he himself summons us up from the grave to meet him face to face. Blessed are you who didn't personally see these things take place and yet believed. And if you aren't yet a loyal follower of Jesus the Messiah, well, here's your opportunity. Let him who gives life to the dead and breathes life into what is spiritually speaking the corpse of your life, let him speak life into your life. He who raised the dead eventually surrendered his own life to make complete atonement for your sins and mine. He beckons you to come to him today and become one of his followers. And he is worthy of all of your devotion. Let's pray. Avinu Malkenu, M'chaye Metim, our Father and our King, you who give life to the dead, we thank you for what Jesus did for Lazarus. We thank you for what you did raising Jesus from the dead. authenticating his claim, validating the fact that we have put, pardon the pun, Father, all our eggs in that one very basket. Our faith is entirely in your Son, Jesus. We thank you for Lazarus' resurrection. We thank you far more for Jesus' resurrection. And we thank you that you raised us up from being spiritually dead to being spiritually alive. And we look forward to the day when you will raise us up physically to be with you forever. Thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. In Jesus' name.